This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have gotten more federal bailout money than anyone else, $145 billion. This week, they asked for $8.5 billion more. But the Senate still can't agree on what their future should look like. NPR's Audie Cornish has the story.
The Federal National Mortgage Association and the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation were created by Congress in order to increase the amount of money available for home loans. But they're actually hybrid organizations with both shareholders and Congress to please. The so-called government-sponsored enterprises don't make mortgages. They buy them from the banks that do, then sell bonds based on those home loans. Fannie and Freddie got into trouble when they jumped into the subprime mortgage market with Wall Street. Of course, Republicans and Democrats differ on what happened next. Those like Arizona Senator John McCain say the GSEs were central to the crisis.
This is one of the prime reasons why 48% of the homes in Arizona are underwater, where people are throwing keys in the middle of the living room floor because they can't afford to make the payments. The enablers were Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Democrats like Banking Committee Chairman Chris Dodd disagree.
Unregulated brokers, unregulated mortgage companies, they were luring people into mortgages they could not afford with no documentation, no background checks whatsoever. That is the genesis of this whole issue. It was not Fannie and Freddie.
Both arguments, unfortunately, are pretty overstated.
Raj Date is a former banker and head of the Cambridge Winter Center. Date says although Fannie and Freddie didn't start the crisis, they certainly made things worse, and the roots of their actions lie with Congress.
Both parties accepted a lot of money from the GSEs during the heyday. Both parties found it politically convenient to let them grow over time and to let their risks grow basically unchecked. There's a problem that's obvious now, and they ought to solve it.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac went from government-sponsored to government-owned in late 2008, when they began to buckle with the housing market. Since then, taxpayers have poured more than $145 billion and counting into those institutions, and that's got to stop, says Alabama Republican Richard Shelby.
You know, and Fannie and Freddie, we're not putting a bandage on them. We're not covering it up. That's an open wound that's still bleeding, hemorrhaging every day.
Republicans tried and failed last night to get an amendment in the Senate Financial Regulatory Bill that would have pulled government aid from the companies, let their charters expire, and eventually transition them to the private sector.
We are not saying that Freddie and Fannie have to go out of business. We are saying we want them to be a business that is on a level playing field with other private sector competitors.
But Obama administration officials want to put off any major changes till next year. And the main author of the financial regulatory bill, Chris Dodd, agrees.
Now today, there's no backup. If 96.5% of mortgages are backed by these two institutions right now, what replaces it? And there isn't any in this amendment. So you're left in a free fall. Who gets hurt? Average Americans. That's who gets hurt.
So instead, the Senate approved an amendment requiring the Treasury to do a study on whether to dissolve, privatize, or break up Fannie and Freddie into smaller companies. In the meantime, the Obama administration has pledged unlimited financial support to keep the institutions going. Audie Cornish, NPR News, The Capitol.
News of Europe's massive bailout to prop up the Greek economy may have helped boost stock markets around the world this week, but as deficits balloon here at home, many wonder how long it's going to be before we find ourselves in the same leaky boat. New York Times columnist David Leonhardt says there are important differences, but like the Greeks, our government spends more than it takes in. Like the Greeks, Americans enjoy ever more generous government benefits, and nobody seems to be ready for the hard choices of less spending and higher taxes. So how about you? What are you willing to pay for more for or willing to give up to avoid a Greek-like crisis here in the U.S.? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. David Leonhardt joins us now from the studios at the Christian Science Monitor here in Washington. You can find his front page column from today's New York Times through a link at our website, npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you say that for any number of reasons, the United States is unlikely to face the same crisis as Greece, but nevertheless, the trend is pretty scary.
That's right. So the reasons we're unlikely to face a Greek-like crisis, we can probably put into two different categories. One, our fiscal situation is not as bad as theirs, according to most estimates. There are some people who think it is, but I don't think it's as bad as theirs. And the second is that we have strengths, political and economic strengths. We control our own monetary policy. We have a currency that a lot of people want to hold. But having said all that, there really are parallels here. And the fundamental problem is the same, even if the degree of it is not. And that problem is that we essentially have created a government that we're not paying for. And we like to talk about the idea of, oh, well, if only we could get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse and these terrible politicians and all this stuff. But the reality is that's not the main problem. And the main problem isn't the war in Iraq, as expensive as it's been. It's not the stimulus program, as much money as that has cost. It's this long-term disconnect between the fact that, on the one hand, we like Medicare, we like Social Security, we like having a strong military, and on the other, we don't like paying the taxes to support all those benefits we want.
Interesting article in USA Today, which reported that the tax rate last year, at the end of last year, was the lowest since 1950.
That's right. The main reason for that is during a recession, tax collections go down because people's income goes down. And also the government put in some one-time tax breaks. But it's also a reflection of the fact that essentially every economic group has had their taxes cut over the last 30 years. The very rich have gotten the biggest tax cut in terms of tax rates, but really everyone's gotten some kind of tax cut. And so that's why revenues are such a low percentage of GDP combined with the recession. And the kind of government we have is not shrinking by any means. It's growing.
Your colleague at the New York Times, Paul Krugman, wrote a blog since your column came out today. Does he throw that into arguments, by the way? Does he ever throw – Pulitzer Prize winner. Excuse me, Nobel Prize winning economist.
Nobel Prize winning.
Nobel Prize winning.
Even better.
Does he throw that every once in a while to settle the arguments?
I mean, he's based in Princeton most of the time.
So he's still a professor.
I see him occasionally, but actually more not at the Times than at the Times.
But anyway, he questions your calculation of how far the U.S. debt will. You say Greece's debt is about 115% of its gross domestic product today, that you project the debt to equal, of the U.S. debt to equal 140% of gross domestic product within two decades. And he says, well, that's based on a lot of faulty and very pessimistic projections.
Yes, although in the end, I think we actually agree. He may not agree, we agree. But he basically said that he takes issue with the notion that we are similar to Greece. And so to some extent, that is a matter of semantics. I agree things aren't as bad in this country as they are in Greece. But I still think they're quite serious. And I apologize if my memory's off here. I think it's the very last sentence of that blog post. Paul says that we would essentially need a fiscal adjustment equal to more than 6%.
That's what he says, yeah.
GDP. Yeah. That's a really big deal. I mean, more than 6% of GDP is getting close to $1 trillion in today's terms. Now, we don't need to make that adjustment immediately, but that's a really significant adjustment. So I'm happy to, for the sake of the debate, agree that an adjustment of 6% of GDP would solve many of our problems, and then we can move on to the issue of how do we actually get there, and we can leave aside the question of does an adjustment of that size make us Greece or not Greece.
Well, and let's get some input from listeners on how we get there. The two options seem to be cut spending or raise taxes. What would you be willing to give up? What would you be willing to pay more for to avoid a Greece-like problem if it is something along the lines of a trillion? And when you say $1 trillion, $1 trillion a year or $1 trillion over the course of how many years?
Well, it's a year, although, again, it's not something we need to start doing immediately.
All right.
The really serious deficit problems, there are really two deficits. There is the short-term deficit that's been created by a combination of the recession, mostly the Bush administration policies, which are basically big tax cuts, two wars, and the Medicare prescription drug benefit. And then third on the list in terms of size is the stimulus program, the Obama stimulus. And so that's the short-term deficit. That starts to shrink over the course of the decade, but sort of just on schedule, we then get the real problem, which is we start to get the long-term Medicare and, to a lesser extent, Social Security deficit growing. And so that's why over the long term we need to look at this kind of fiscal adjustment that's in the neighborhood of something like 6% of GDP, and that is every year.
And when you're talking about the Bush tax cuts, they are set to expire. There are going to be a lot of people arguing to keep them in force. You don't increase taxes effectively during a recession. But anyway, that's another argument, and I guess that's part of the argument. Let's get Clint on the line. Clint's calling us from Moultrie in Georgia.
Yeah, that's right. What I'd be willing to give up is a black budget like defense spending. You know, from what it seems to me, it seems like, you know, we're spending undisclosed amounts of money to fight, a Cold War era style war, you know, when, you know, the truth is that we're no longer, we're no longer in that kind of conflict, you know.
When you talk about black budget, you mean the stuff that we don't know about that's buried in somewhere?
Yeah. You know, the stuff that, like, the undisclosed, like, defense spending is what I'm talking about.
Well, it's buried somewhere. I mean, we do know about it. We just don't know what we're voting for when we vote for it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, defense spending, whether black or overt, David Leonhardt, can you get $1 trillion a year out of that?
You can't, but it's big. It's now in the neighborhood of $650 billion. One of the real problems with defense spending is that it has already been shrinking quite significantly as a share of GDP. I don't remember the numbers exactly off the top of my head, but it's a few percentage point of GDP down from where it was. So if it's 650 now, that is in the neighborhood of 4 to 5% of GDP, and that is way down. And so it's way down from the Cold War and the Vietnam War era. And I think we would all agree that we need some kind of military, right? And we probably want a pretty strong military based on the seriousness of the threats that there are around the world. So,
yeah, but an appropriate military.
Could you cut $100 billion out of the military budget, which would, I mean, be really quite significant? I don't know, but I'm open to that idea. It doesn't get us anywhere close to solving the larger
10%
gap. Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I think it's an important potential part of the solution.
Clint, thanks very much for the call. Here's from Cameron, an email. I could do without two wars, cheap gasoline, and excessive profits for business. 1 year of our nation's net profits might cancel our nation's debt. It would hurt bad, but a deep depression would hurt worse. And that seems to be more a philosophical stance than exactly what he is willing to pay more for or do less with. Let's see if we can get this is James. James with us from Flagstaff.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, please.
I'd be willing to pay more for taxes. I think my wife and I are both in social services in Arizona, which is kind of a difficult situation in the state right now. And both of us have been laid off in the past year because of budget cuts in the state. And I would definitely be willing to pay more for taxes, even though, you know, our measly little social work salary doesn't give much to give up. But I think people just lack perspective of personal responsibility and economic crises.
Mm-hmm.
And they look out for their personal peace and affluency in times like this.
Well, David Leonhardt will certainly agree with you on that last point. People lack that sense of personal responsibility for the budget. You say essentially in your column, the problem is us.
I do think a big part of the problem is us. And I think part of the problem is politicians as well. But I think a big part of the problem is us. And one of the things that we've forgotten is the idea that we get something for our taxes. We get schools. We get the military. We get Medicare and Social Security. We get a lot of things that, when you look at polling data and you just use common sense, are tremendously popular. There just aren't a lot of people who want to give up Medicare, right?
Right.
One of the big parts of the healthcare debate were a lot of people in this country who have universal healthcare saying that they don't want to have to give up any of it so that other people can have universal healthcare, right? That's
right.
The over 65 crowd talking to the under 65 crowd. And so I think it's important to remember that, yes, sometimes government revenue is spent poorly. But there are also lots of times in which it's spent well. It's these popular programs. It's the fact that the private sector didn't build the internet. The government did. The private sector then built a lot of wonderful companies that the government never could have built, but the Defense Department built the internet, and the federal government built the highway system, and local schools that people say in polls they really like, those are government entities. And this incredibly successful biotechnology industry we have needed a huge amount of government funding to get off the ground. And there is a long history of societies, as they get richer, deciding that they want more services provided by the government. They want more health care. They want more education. They want more military. They want more of a safety net. And so it's actually quite natural and quite in keeping with history that as a society becomes richer, the share of its revenue that it devotes to government goes up. Our problem is that we want to have it both ways. We do want to increase the size of our economy that goes to government. We just don't want to increase the size of our economy that goes to paying for that government. And that can't last. We either have to do things like get rid of Medicare in its current form and get tax and keep taxes low, or we have to increase taxes. My sense is we have to do both. We have to increase taxes and also find ways to reduce the growth of spending in the future.
And you can to read about those calculations in David Leonhardt's column that was published on the front page of the New York Times today. There's a link to it on our website at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. David Leonhardt, New York Times economics columnist, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And when it comes to European issues, they don't get much bigger than the ongoing economic crisis there. The euphoria over the plan to stabilize the monetary system has already dissipated. Investors in European governments are now focusing on the challenges that remain if the region's debt and deficit issues are to be resolved. That reality is especially painful for Spain. The country has come a long way in the last 30 years, but Spaniards are realizing their place in Europe is not yet secure. From Madrid, NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
The King of Spain, Juan Carlos, had surgery here last Saturday, a minor operation, but it dominated the news all weekend. The King is revered here, in large part because of the role he played in Spain's transition to democracy after the death of longtime dictator Francisco Franco. When military officers attempted to seize power in 1981, the king stood up to them, and they backed down. In the years that followed the king's courageous stand, Spain became modern. The national will was clear. Spain would join the rest of Europe. Economist and newspaper commentator Fernando Fernandez says there was a social consensus in the country to reform.
This social consensus was underpinned by the obsession to become a regular European country. We had the excuse to be like the European. So in a way, it was easy because all we had to do is, well, let's see what the Europeans do, let's copy it.
But it's precisely this idea of being a regular European country that may be jeopardized now by the debt crisis. What happened was Spain got a little carried away with what it meant to be like the Europeans. For too many, it was a lifestyle, eating well, nice vacations, fancy cars. Gerardo Viada, now a prominent Madrid lawyer, came of age during this period and saw a change in his country's behavior. Spain went from poverty to wealth in the manner of the newly rich, Gerardo says. Everyone bought things, invested in things, without having a solid base underneath. For years, Spain got away with it. The economy was vibrant, and with the introduction of the euro currency, banks were eager to lend. But it wasn't enough. Fernando Fernandez, who teaches at the IE Business School, says Spain fell into what he calls the European trap.
In a way, the country has lost its purpose. We wanted to be Europe and we wanted to be rich. We wanted to be as rich as the Europeans and as civilized, as democratic, as tolerant, as liberal, etc. Now, we've accomplished that in many areas and now we've lost the next goal. What do we want to be when we grow up?
Spain's identification was with a united Europe. But the debt crisis has divided Europe more than it's been since the European Union was created. Spain's overspending associated it with Europe's Mediterranean periphery, not with its Franco-German core. And that's not what Spaniards had in mind when their country merged with Europe. José Ignacio Torreblanca directs the Madrid office of the European Council on Foreign Relations.
The cracks within Europe, between North and South, are very revealing. People are looking at each other with prejudices, stubborn Germans versus, you know, spendthrifters, Latins, and so all this is back on the table.
Torreblanca, who's 41, is part of the Spanish generation that takes its European identity for granted. He was amused recently at a conference in Madrid when an aging military officer stood up and thanked visitors who had come, in his words, from Europe to attend the meeting, as if it were somewhere else. But now Spaniards have to face that very prospect, that their country is slipping into a second European tier, scorned by its northern neighbors and by the bond markets, which aren't convinced the country will demonstrate budget discipline. Torreblanca argues his country from here on should focus more on its own problems and advantages and less on its relative living standard.
We should get our homework done, as we've done in the past, and in that, markets are always reminders of the things you have to do.
After all, learning discipline is part of growing up. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Madrid.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
To Greece now, where that country's economic outlook has improved, but it will take a long time before its books are in order. The Greek government is facing a problem a lot of ordinary people can relate to: too much debt and not enough money coming in. So David Kestenbaum with our Planet Money team called up a well-known personal finance guru to get some advice for Greece.
If you've got credit card debt or teenagers who overspend, there is always one place you can go. One man you know can help you out.
Live from Financial Peace Plaza, it's the Dave Ramsey Show, where debt is dumb, cash is king.
Dave Ramsey, mega popular radio host, TV host, author of multiple books, balancer of family checkbooks, and starting right here, informal financial advisor for Greece.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. Thank you so much for doing this. Greece really is not so different from the mothers, retirees, small business owners who call into his radio show behind on their bills. I explained to Dave that I have this friend. I'm calling because I have a friend who's in a lot of debt.
Okay. How much?
$405 billion.
Wow, that's a little bit. So what's his annual income?
He's a pretty high wage earner, actually, $343 billion.
So he owes more than he makes in a year. Wow. So we're throwing around billions, but I mean, let's just put that in perspective. This is a guy making $100,000 a year who owes $150,000 in credit card debt. Ah!
Greece borrows money not using a credit card, but by issuing bonds. It's the same kind of thing, though. Until recently, the interest rate on its bonds was up to 12%, like having very high monthly payments. And Greece got into this mess because it was overspending, splurging on salaries and pensions it couldn't afford. It's okay for governments to have some debt. A government may need to borrow to build things like roads or shipping ports or power plants, but you want your economy to grow as a result so you can pay that money back. And Greece just isn't growing that fast. Here's Dave's analysis.
The ratio you look at when you're trying to get anyone out of debt, whether it's a company, a country, or an individual, is what we call the ratio of shovel to hole. How much of a hole are you in versus the shovel you've got? Well, he's got a year plus of his entire wages to clean up debt. So this is going to take a decade of deep sacrifice.
I tell Dave that my friend has some options. He's part of a powerful family, the European Union, who's very angry with him, in part because he lied about his financial troubles for a while. Greece underreported its deficit. But my friend's family really wants him to pull through, so they are willing to bail him out, which they're doing to the tune of $100 billion. Dave isn't so sure getting rescued by mom, dad, or Germany is such a good idea.
Well, let's say your teenager came home from college and unbeknownst to you, in secret, has run up $50,000 in credit card debt, which they can do now in college. And if I just write Junior a check for 50 grand and bail him out and he has no pain as a result of his misbehavior and he doesn't change his wicked ways, were I to put cash into that, I'd be called an enabler. I'd be giving a drunk a drink.
Dave Ramsey says he'd put some belt-tightening conditions on any parental bailout, which is what the international community is doing. But Dave says that's not enough.
You haven't dealt with Greece's real problem.
Even with the bailout, Greece will still have debt, still be spending more than it earns. Ramsey says, sorry, people of Greece, I love your country, but you need to quit it with the street protests. He calls them temper tantrums. Make some life changes. Say to yourselves these three magic words: I've had it.
When people and when companies and when countries have that moment where they draw a line in the sand and they say, I'm not going to do this anymore, It takes that passion to break the orbital pull of stupid. Stupid has a gravitational pull, and it will pull you back in.
Dave says the data from his world of personal financial advice is not so encouraging. Most people who consolidate their debt are back in trouble within 2 years. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.